the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. And my guest this week is Lieutenant General Richard Natonsky, the Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps for plans, policies, and operations. General Natonsky's career has included assignments in Vietnam, Europe, the Caribbean, and the Middle East. In 2004, he commanded the 1st Marine Division through counterinsurgency operations, the Battle of Fallujah, and the Iraqi national elections in January of 2005. We began our discussion with his formative years and his decision to become a Marine.
Well, you know, I did grow up in Connecticut. My parents were transferred when I was about 4 years old from upstate New York, where very ethnic community, all of the immigrants, and my parents are both Lithuanian and Polish, so their parents all worked in the mills up in Amsterdam, New York. My father worked for General Electric and was transferred down to White Plains when I was very young. So I grew up in Connecticut, never moved, unlike my own children who moved throughout my career. Went to the University of Louisville as an NROTC scholarship student and went into the Marine Corps. But I knew as a young kid that's what I wanted to do. My father had been a PFC, and he said, you ought to go into the Navy and fly, because he also flew, but he had been a machine gunner in the Marine Corps. And he said, oh, that's a rough life. And I said, no, that's what I want to do. And here I am 34 years later, and I'm still in the Marines.
Did you still feel the same way after TBS, the basic school?
I did. This is what I wanted to do all my life, and I'm blessed to have been able to have a career in the service.
Well, that career has taken you to any number of places, from Southeast Asia to the Caribbean to Europe, Western Europe to the Middle East, to you name it. And let's talk a little bit about the Middle East, and particularly the story of Fallujah, because we've had a number of people on this program who participated in it or have written about it, but we have not had anybody who actually commanded those troops, and you were the commander of the 1st Marine Division. Was that the most difficult assignment in combat that you experienced?
I think it was a difficult assignment. I'm not sure it was the hardest. We had a big battle during OIF-1 when I was part of the invasion force and commanded Task Force Toroa in a city called An-Nasiriyya. And different scenarios, both urban areas. In one, I had all the forces I needed. In the other, I was kind of an economy of force operation. But there are challenges everywhere you go. And of course, in the Marine Corps, we have a mindset that we always want to accomplish our mission, but at the same time take care of our Marines and our sailors.
Well, that was not easy, particularly in Fallujah or in any other place, but Fallujah was particularly bloody, it seemed to me, in reading accounts of it.
You know, I assumed command of the 1st Marine Division in August in country in Iraq in August of 2004. We were doing counterinsurgency operations at that time, and of course Fallujah had been spread worldwide in the news in the March-April timeframe when four American Blackwater contractors were mercilessly murdered in the city. And the city had just degenerated to that point in time, and by September of 2004 it was an enemy sanctuary only 40 miles west of Baghdad. And in about September, President Alawi and our own leadership in Iraq had determined that Fallujah, as an enemy sanctuary, could no longer be tolerated. If you recall, they had scheduled the first national election in Iraq, the first national election ever, on the 30th of January in 2005. But as long as the insurgents controlled Fallujah, they could launch their attacks towards Baghdad, towards Ramadi, and throughout the middle of Iraq, disrupt the coalition, disrupt the election, and at the same time go back, rest, refit, train in Fallujah, and then go back out. Plus, it was a murderous location where you saw any number of hostages that were brutally murdered in the city. So at the middle of September, we were given the word to start planning an attack to take back the city. And as the 1st Marine Division commander, my boss, Lieutenant General Sattler, who commanded the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, gave the assignment for the actual assault into the city to the division. So we started planning in September of 2004. And just like any business, you develop courses of action. You war game those courses of action. You pick the one that you think is best. You identify the resources you need, and you continue planning. And that's what we did throughout September and October leading up to the battle. One of the things we determined was we wanted to do it right. We wanted to do it deliberately, and we needed more forces. I had taken some risk by moving forces from western Al-Anbar province, which was our area of responsibility, to move for the battle, but it still did not give us all the forces we needed. We determined we needed a couple Army mechanized battalions, and we also wanted an Army brigade to help seal the city as we assaulted into the city.
I smile at that because I recall in one book I read your request to higher authority, and they came back and said, phrase it a little bit differently, right?
You're absolutely right. I told General Sattler, I said, sir, these are the types of units I need. And he went to General Casey, and General Casey was forthcoming. He understood the gravity of the situation. And unlike the time when I came into the Marine Corps in the early 70s, we'd come a long way in our services. The Goldwater-Nichols Act kind of mandated we would do things jointly. And I don't think you've probably could have picked a more joint force that we went into Fallujah with. I had Marine regiments with Army battalions in them. Those two mech battalions that I had were embedded inside Army regiments. I had two Army brigades, and inside those Army brigades, I had Marine battalions. Mm-hmm. We had Navy SEAL sniper teams. We had Air Force dog teams. We had the British Black Watch, which had been moved up to Basra towards an area east of the city of Fallujah, between Fallujah and Baghdad, to prevent any enemy reinforcements from coming into the city and at the same time preventing any escape from the city of Fallujah. We had six battalions of Iraqi security forces, and to date, those were the best forces we had had. We dealt with some Iraqi National Guard, which were very, very weak, but the Iraqi Army units, some of which many of the soldiers had fought against us in 2003, and others had fought against us in Desert Storm, but they took great pride in their units. And they were a mixture of Shia, Sunni, and Kurds. And they took great pride in their units. They were pretty well led, and they had Army and Marine advisors, and they proved critical during the operation as well.
You changed your tactics a little bit too, as I recall, attacking from a different direction this time, and instead of on the first battle for Fallujah, you're going up toward the north. You came down from the south, right?
We did, and part of our planning, and I think we did a lot of good things in the prep up to the attack phase. We tried to set the battlefield. One, we dropped leaflets on the city to try to drive a wedge between the people and the insurgents. And what this ultimately resulted in, a lot of the civilians left the city. They moved in with relatives in Baghdad and other locations throughout the country of Iraq. What it meant was mostly insurgents left in the city. We also tried to hit some of the key command and control nodes within the city. I mean, we'd do everything to flying a plane low at treetop level over the city and then trying to determine where the communications were originating from, so we knew where their command and control nodes were. We also conducted a number of feints at the city, primarily from the eastern half of the city, because that's where some of the earlier fighting the previous spring had taken place. So we wanted to give them the idea that was the direction we were coming from. And we believe, based on the reconnaissance, both through unmanned aerial vehicles and photo reconnaissance, we saw the enemy building his defenses, primarily oriented to the east. But at the same time, we were doing feints from the south and the north just so we didn't tip our hand. We knew we weren't going to get operational surprise because they knew as we moved forces down, Army forces, Iraqi forces into the area, they knew that a battle was coming. But we thought we could achieve tactical surprise with respect to the direction the attack was going to originate from. And in this case, when we finally assaulted into the city, we assaulted from the north. And I think we did get a measure of surprise. And we wanted to do this as fast as we could. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do it using our technological advantage. We did not want to give the enemy the IO advantage. We call it information operations. We did not want a protracted campaign in Fallujah because the longer it went, the more the news media worldwide would have a city to showcase. And I think one of the lessons learned the previous April was that the media ultimately helped tip the scales against the coalition attack into the city and eventually forced the Marine forces to withdraw for the city. And that's when the Fallujah Brigade was created to try to get the enemy out of the city and recover all of the arms caches that were in the city of Fallujah.
Well, that's interesting because the media influence, and now that I think about it, I can see exactly where you're coming from, but I had been under the impression that there was another example here of Pentagon and White House micromanagement of events on the ground and that the orders to break off in the previous spring came from that source, but you're suggesting that it did so because of the pressure that media were generating.
I think that was the wide-held belief that we were winning on the ground, but we were losing the battle in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say for Second Fallujah, one General Casey had briefed the president and on our plan of attack, and I had a green light that once we launched this attack, no one would stop us until we were done.
We're talking this week with Lieutenant General Richard Atonsky, Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps, for plans, policies, and operations. Our conversation continues after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with the Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps for Plans, Policies, and Operations, Lieutenant General Richard Natonsky.
You've used the term insurgent several times. I want to know what your definition of an insurgent is, because back here, at any rate, you read about the Sunnis, you read about the Shias, you read about Al-Qaeda, you read about disaffected young Iraqi men who were discharged from when the army was broken up. What kind of insurgents are you talking about that controlled Fallujah?
And that's a very good question. There were a number of groups that banded together in the city of Fallujah. One, you had your disenchanted former Baathists and Iraqi army members. They were under the regime of Saddam Hussein. They had had power. And now that the regime had fallen, they were disenchanted. They did not want the coalition in their country. They were against the Shia They were a portion of the enemy. We also had a lot of foreign fighters. And you've heard me mention about the Iraqi security forces. In the city, when we had a number of detainees lined up, these Iraqi army soldiers could go down the line, and just by talking to the prisoners, they would tell you that, well, this individual is from the country of Morocco, this is from Saudi Arabia, this is from Iraq, this individual is from Tunisia. Just like you could tell after talking to a number of Americans, he's from New York City, he's from Boston, and he's from down south, just by their accents.
Right.
And we found a lot of well-equipped insurgent foreign fighters. We also found a criminal element, because remember, Saddam cleared out the prisons before he fell. So you had probably, I speculate, but I've heard the number 80,000 prisoners on the run throughout Iraq. So you had this coalition and some tribal members also who were in for their own vested reasons. So you had a loose coalition, and at one time Zarqawi was actually running things from Fallujah. Unfortunately, he snuck out of the city before we actually assaulted into the city. He left his fighters to hold down the fort while he ran away. And these fighters, as I said, were well-equipped. Many of them were using amphetamines. They were there to fight to the death. Some actually had put rubber hosing around their limbs like tourniquets, because if they felt if they were shot or lost a limb, they could continue fighting. And it was a very, very hardcore enemy. And if it wasn't for the bravery of the Marines and soldiers, the young riflemen that launched the attack through that city, I just have so much pride in their performance and the tough job they had going into house after house after house, never knowing whether there was enemy inside. And, you know, we had one instance where, just to give you a kind of an example of these young kids, several days into the battle, we had a squad of Marines lined out, ready to go in and clear another house, probably the fifth or sixth of the day. They form a stack, which is a line. You've seen it on TV, on a SWAT team, or on whenever we clear a house, we have a breacher, someone that will knock the door open with a sledgehammer or shoot the lock off with a shotgun. He knocks the door open, then the point man leads the squad into the building to clear all the rooms. On this particular day, the squad was lined up. The breacher knocked the door in. The Marines ran in, started clearing. The point man was shot by insurgents waiting inside the house. Marines returned fire, pulled the wounded Marine outside the house, outside a wall. There were walls around most of the buildings in the city. They treated the Marine, called a medevac, got him out up to the aid station. And then the Marines got into an argument. It was an argument about who was going to go. They knew they had to go clear that house, and it was an argument of who's going to be the point man for the next go-around. And, of course, the point man was going to be the first one going in, and they knew there was enemy in this house. It wasn't the kind of argument you would have anticipated. No, they didn't want to go. They all wanted to be the first guy to go in. You went first the last time. It's my time. It's my turn now. No, it's you went two houses ago. It's my turn. They finally came to a resolution of the argument as to who was going to go first in this house. And then they started talking about Fallujah the movie and who was going to play their character in the movie. Was it going to be Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt? That's the kind of kid, even under fire in the city of Fallujah, still had the humor and the mindset. That's the kind of national treasure we have in this country.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more about that, and we've been privileged to have some of them stop by here and tell us about their experiences there and elsewhere in the Corps, as a matter of fact. We'll be back with more from Marine Corps Lieutenant General Richard Dutonsky after these messages.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face. That's the ammunition and
the for Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Joining me this week is the Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps for Plans, Policies, and Operations, Lieutenant General Richard Natonsky. Your portfolio here is Plans, Policies, and Operations. I mean, that just about covers the field, it seems to me. But on the business of both policy and operations, we came to the conclusion some time ago that the Westmoreland strategy was not working in Vietnam. Creighton Abrams had a very different philosophy, which resulted in a different policy, which resulted in a different kind of operation, which from everything I have read was actually proving to be highly successful at, as it was implemented, this clear and hold. But did we learn anything from that?
Well, you know, things evolve over time. OIF won the initial invasion isn't the fight we're fighting today. When we went into Iraq in 2003, we could have never imagined that we would probably be involved in an insurgency today.
Were we misled by the immediate and sudden success of OFI-1 into thinking that this is the kind of war that we're still going to have to be fighting in the future?
Well, you know, as Marines, we try to cover the entire spectrum of warfare, from the counterinsurgency to the type of fight we had in OIF-1, which was full-out conventional operations using all the assets at hand. I think you're seeing a different strategy in Iraq today with General Petraeus. I think it's good. Initial reports seem to be indicating we're having some success. I know in the Al-Anbar province, our Commandant General Conway was there very recently, and we're seeing some positive signs. Al-Anbar being part of the Sunni Triangle, part of the problems we had was trying to win the hearts and minds. I know that's kind of a cliche, but that's very, very important.
But it's true. It has to be done.
It does, and it was very, very hard because of what we know is what we call the insurgents, those individuals who really don't want us to succeed in that country. But they had such a murder and intimidation campaign, killing children, killing women. For example, in Ramadi, some charitable organizations here in the States had donated sewing machines. And we'd set up a sewing center in Ramadi for the Iraqi women to give them jobs so they could earn money and give them a place to go. The insurgents went and blew it up. They blew up a Red Crescent medical office in Ramadi. And it's really tough. You know, we want to go in there and try to rebuild the schools. And that was one of the things we tried to do in driving a wedge between the people and the insurgents in Fallujah, telling them that every day the insurgents were there was a day, one less day they would have without a water treatment plant or their schools being renovated. I think what's happened over time in the Al-Anbar province is the tribal chiefs, and it's an interesting country, but the tribes have quite a bit of control over the people in many parts in Iraq. And in the Al-Anbar province, they've kind of gotten fed up with the murder of their tribal members, with the murder of their family members, and now they've started to cooperate with the coalition forces. We have both Army and Marines in the Al-Anbar province. And before, for an American, when you're fighting an insurgency, the enemy's not wearing a uniform. The only way you can tell an insurgent is because he's shooting at you. Once he runs away and he ditches his rifle, he blends into the crowd. There's no way of detecting that individual walking the streets a bad guy. However, the locals know. They know who's from outside of the area, who's from outside of the country. And when they start pointing out the bad guys, then we can go after them. And we have brought a measure of stability in places like Ramadi and the Euphrates Valley where we've had problems. problems there before. We're starting to get the support of the people, and I think that's important. In Baghdad, it's a little different scenario. In Baghdad, they're kind of in the middle between the Shia and the Sunni, and they're trying to establish security by pushing the troops out into the city. And I think there has been a reduction in the number of executions and murders in the city. But we're trying to establish security. But at the same time, you also have to look at it from an economic perspective and a governmental perspective. You know, the government has to rule this country, which is a number of groups. It has to pay attention to the Sunni. It has to pay attention to the Kurds. And that's where I think the State Department and the politicians need to focus. And at the same time, you have all of these young males who literally when the Iraqi army ceased to exist, were out jobs. And there's a high unemployment rate in Iraq. So you have to find jobs. You have to create jobs to give these people pride in what they're doing and to get them focused away from the insurgency, because sometimes the only option for a young man to feed his family is to lay an IED, a roadside bomb, because he's got to feed his family. And we have to split that. And I think only time will tell how General Petraeus's strategy works. Unfortunately, in this country, we're very impatient, and we want to see results now.
Yes, it did.
And I only hope that we give an opportunity to see if we can succeed in Iraq. Because, you know, the young men and women serving over there, they believe in what they're doing, and they've seen the results. Unfortunately, in the news media today, you only see the negative, because that's what appeals to that's what people spend money for the news, the commercials, the newspapers. You know, building a hospital isn't necessarily newsworthy, but
it should be. It should be.
I wish it was.
You mentioned the third leg of this stool, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, and that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, in my opinion, in the press back here. And I wonder how much that is on the radar screen of people like yourself involved in policies and planning and operations as a potential concern. It seems to be Pacific, if you could use that term these days, but is it because it's so homogeneous, because of where it is geographically?
I'm not really sure, and of course, the Kurdish problem in Iraq is well beyond my pay grade. when we talk about policy and strategy, right. I'm primarily focused on the Marine Corps, but you do have a Kurdish area, and they're doing pretty well in northern Iraq. They had a tough time under Saddam, but they do have oil resources, as do the Shia. The Shia and the Basra area down in southern Iraq, but the Sunni don't. Now, there's some thought that there may be some vast oil resources in the Al-Anbar province, and that would be an economic boom for this country. But once again, you see the insurgents that are blowing up oil lines, electrical infrastructure. You know, one of the things we wanted to make sure we did in the Battle of Fallujah was right on the tail of our combat forces, we were fighting a term coined by General Krulak, one of our former commandants, called the three-block war. And in the three-block war, you may be fighting full-out combat operations on one block, patrolling on the second block, and doing humanitarian aid on the third block. And as we were fighting in the southern part of the city, we had electrical engineers from the Iraqi power companies restoring power. We had Seabees cleaning up rubble and trying to pump out some of the water in the city where we had flooding. It is on the Euphrates River, and it's very much like New Orleans. It's kind of below sea level, so when the pumps aren't working, sections of the city flooded. But along the same lines of working not just the military portion, but the economic and the political piece, Iran is primarily made up of three factions, the Shia, which are the majority, but were not the majority under Saddam Hussein. The Sunni were, and then you had the Kurds. And today the Shia, as a result of a number of elections, are in power with Prime Minister Maliki. And I think that sometimes there's a mindset for retribution for days gone by. But in order to govern Iraq, I think you have to take into account all of the factions, and you have to build a government that looks after the needs of all three. Otherwise, you're going to leave one disenfranchised, and they will be a problem. And I think right now the Sunni do feel a bit disenfranchised. One of the things we had been promised before we went into Fallujah was, I think, about $100 million from the government in Baghdad for rebuilding. We tried to minimize the damage, but when you're fighting house to house, and if it meant sending Marines or soldiers into a house or that was filled with insurgents or knocking it down with a bulldozer or an Amtrak or a bomb, we'd opt for that second option because we wanted to safeguard those lives. They were too precious for us. But we did do some destruction. In fact, areas of the city were very reminiscent of a city like Stalingrad. But we also wanted to go in and rebuild. And it took us a long time to get those funds because it was a Shia government focused on the Shia giving money to the Sunni. And that, I think, causes problems. And to me, I don't understand how people in the same country can... It's not an American mentality. We get along with the South, we get along with the West in this country, and we're a mixing bowl of different cultures and peoples. But in other parts of the world, like the Middle East and the Balkans, and Northern Ireland, as we talked about before, there are long-standing, centuries-old fissions between different sects or different people, and that's what we're seeing in Iraq today.
I want to turn attention to a different topic here for a minute in the remaining time that we have and talk about the future of the Marine Corps. You're going to be going from 82,000 to, I believe, 102,000. Is that right?
No, sir. It's 202,000.
200.
We're right at
182 to 200.
Absolutely, right. 202,000, and this is a great thing. If you look back in our history, the Army's also growing. But if you look back in our history, on the eve of World War I, on the eve of World War II, on the eve of the Korean War, you know, you saw an American military that was pretty small. It was not...
It was pretty neglected, in one word.
Yes, sir. Exactly. Both in equipment and in manpower. And one of the Commandant's initiatives has been to increase the size of the Marine Corps. One, to meet the initial problems we're having with dwell time. Because, you know, right now, Marines are going over for 7 months, coming home for 7 months, or in some cases, even less. We want to address some of the structure in the Marine Corps to give relief so that Marines can be home for longer periods of time. But we also want to better balance the Marine Corps across. We have three Marine Expeditionary Forces, one at Camp Lejeune, one at Camp Pendleton, and one on Okinawa. But had we been better balanced when the war started, we probably wouldn't be having as many of the problems we are with the shortfalls. Intel personnel, military police, truck drivers, infantry units, unmanned aerial vehicle units, attack squadron, attack helo squadrons. These are some of the units that we just didn't have enough depth in the Marine Corps. And we have to look to the future. Iraq is the first battle in a long war. We have to be prepared to meet the challenges of the future, and we don't want to find ourselves coming up short. And there are people that say, well, there'll never be another protracted land war. I think they probably said that after World War I, and they probably said it after World War II, and you know, they said that after Korea, too. And have we not learned from history that we need ground forces, Marines and Army? And, you know, we pride ourselves in the Marine Corps as being the most ready when the country's least ready, and we want to be ready for those future challenges as well. And we think that a manpower increase, which unfortunately costs money, but I think our nation needs to make a commitment because we don't want to get ourselves caught flat-footed in the future. We're in an all-volunteer force today. We don't have the draft to fall back on.
My guest this week has been Lieutenant General Richard Natonski, Deputy Commandant of the Marine Corps for plans, policies, and operations.
That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.